to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow. And we're broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Beautiful Vancouver, I might add. It has been absolutely gorgeous the last week. And it's shaping up to be another amazing day. Temperature-wise, very, very hot. So I hope you have gotten the chance to get out there in the sunshine. Just don't get too sunburned. Make sure to put on some suntan lotion or sunscreen or... Are those the same thing? I don't know, actually. I suppose I could look it up. That is really lazy of me not to look that up right now. But we have a great show today. No time to look up suntan lotion stuff. We have a great show today on The Sector. We're going to be discussing last week's big question of the week. I asked you, does protesting work? And we'll see what sort of responses we get, as well as discussing some of the tactics and perhaps some of the debate that exists out there on whether or not a protest will actually accomplish anything, or if it can simply turn public opinion against you and actually damage the cause. So we'll look into that as well. We also have some interesting nonprofit-related news when it comes to donating. And that's always interesting, finding out what makes donors tick, and some interesting thoughts on the notion of responsibility. Do you donate to a cause where the recipient is responsible for their position to need donations? Well, weeks ago, I received a direct mail appeal from none other than the University of British Columbia, my old alma mater, and of course, the home of CITR. And I'm holding the envelope in my hands right now. You can hear me rattle it there. This is an unopened direct mail appeal for their 2014 annual alumni appeal. It's a nice, clean, white envelope with some fancy writing on it. We're going to open this live on the air. Now, I realize you guys can't see this, of course, that the limitations of radio continue to flummox us. But nevertheless, I'm going to open it, and I'm going to describe what's in this letter. You know, maybe you have received this very letter yourself, and you'll be able to relate. I've given it a bit of time. This originally arrived several weeks ago, but the campaign's been off to, I would assume, a good start, so I didn't want to, you know... I didn't want to poo-poo their ideas right when it came out. So, given a bit of time, if you have received this, it was probably a few weeks ago. So we'll open it together. We'll examine this direct mail. And if you need a reminder about what direct mail is, I will fill you in on that later on in the show. So look forward to that exploration of donor feedback. Well, as I said, lots to discuss on today's show. Why don't we start off with the big question of the week? Now, speaking of protesting, of course, you may have heard about the World Cup of football, or as we know it in North America, soccer. The game that I think everyone is talking about, of course, happened on Tuesday the 8th, where host nation Brazil played off against Germany in the semifinals. And boy, what a match. I don't think I've ever seen a team lose that badly at soccer in my life. 7-1 for Germany over Brazil. The sad faces in the audience was especially hard to take. Those poor crying Brazilian children. Oh, those poor kids. And of course, if you were on the internet or Twitter, you of course saw all kinds of hilarious memes mocking, perhaps a little cruelly, the Brazilian sadness of losing their World Cup. And then, of course, this was what they thought they were going to win. They were the host nation. Everything was riding on them. And they lost. In spectacular fashion. Well, fortunately for Brazil, those games will be tuning in for that. Now, one of the interesting aspects about this relating to protesting is that Shortly after Brazil lost, a lot of memes went around the internet depicting riots going on in the streets of Brazil. Pretty serious riots by the look of it. Now, a good deal of those were fake. They were photo manipulated, people recycling old images of old riots in Brazil and claiming that these were soccer riots. There actually were a few disruptions by some upset Brazilian soccer fans, causing a bit of damage here and there. Again, I don't know exactly how much, and hopefully no one was hurt, but it wasn't on the scale of a massive soccer riot, storming stadiums, that sort of thing. Now, the reason, though, that I bring this up is because we would assume that Brazil, a soccer-loving nation, would be absolutely thrilled to be hosting the World Cup. That wasn't the case. In fact, there were a lot of Brazilians who were really, really upset that the World Cup was happening in Brazil. Now, you might ask why. Because they hate soccer? No, they absolutely love soccer. It's because many Brazilians are living in communities and cities with incredible economic depression. There are a lot of inequities going on in Brazil right now. Lots of major social problems that need to be resolved. Big issues relating to infrastructure as well as class inequality. So a lot of people in Brazil were saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't be spending the billions of dollars building stadiums and preparing for a big soccer match. Now, this may sound familiar to Vancouverites because Vancouver recently hosted the Olympics in 2010. And many of the same arguments that existed for the anti-Olympics existed for the anti-World Cup in Brazil. Namely that, while a big party is a lot of fun, there are more pressing concerns in society that we should be investing in, that we should be building for. Instead of building new stadiums, new highways, new ski lifts, etc., etc., we should be building infrastructure for helping homelessness, building new hospitals, restructuring and reinforcing our existing roads and transit. So these are all genuine concerns, real issues that need to be addressed. And when they weren't addressed here in Vancouver or in Brazil, people got pretty upset about it. So we saw the rise of the anti-Olympic coverage here in Vancouver. Why did it fail? Now, obviously, with the Olympics, there are a lot of factors that go into it. The Olympics is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's controlled and it is supported by major, long-standing, powerful institutions in society, from media, government, various stages of corporations and sponsors. They all have their hand in the Olympic basket. So it's not really a surprise, then, that a grassroots anti-establishment protest would make a huge dent in it. But what about things like the Occupy movement, which for a very long time was front and center on major newspapers, major news coverages? It was big. It was a big deal. And everybody thought, wow, this is going to actually create real change. But it didn't. I mean, it created some change, and certainly things are more front and center. We're talking more about income inequality. We're talking more about class struggle than we were before. But I don't think anyone would disagree that the promises of Occupy have fallen short of the deliverables. So why? Why didn't it work? So there are protesting. Did it help? Did it hinder? What are the reasons why? What do you think? Remember, if you want to participate in the big question here on this, invite your feedback. We love your feedback. And you can do so in several different ways. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can also follow us on Twitter at sectorpodcast, or you can follow me at Ethan Clow. I'm on Twitter as well. And of course, we're on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. Feel free to like us and visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you will find all of our show notes, so all of our references and scholarly articles to back up all the stuff that I say, as well as links to the podcast if you want to share it with your friends. And please do, because we love that. And so many ways to contribute to the big question. Let's just take a quick break here on the sector, and we'll come back and discuss protesting in depth coming up next.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that...
CITR!
Can be mighty helpful.
Yeehaw!
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
We are back on The Sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, and we're discussing the big question of the week, where I pose a question to our listening audience and I invite your feedback. I invite you to discuss, criticize, and comment on an interesting question related to nonprofits and social justice. Last week on the show, I asked about protesting. Does it work? And I was talking before the break about the anti-Olympics coverage here in Vancouver, the protesting, the civil disobedience, and I also talked a bit about the anti-World Cup protesting that went on in Brazil, where we know that Brazilians love soccer even when they lose 7-1, but yet they protested the World Cup games. So in those two cases, why didn't we see any change? Why didn't the protests make a difference? Why didn't the Occupy protests have a more lasting impact? Why was the Occupy protests, let's say, largely unsuccessful, and yet some of the protests that happened in the Middle East during the Arab Spring, or that happened in Eastern Europe that overthrew governments, why were some of those protests successful, and yet Occupy failed? Why indeed? You know, there's an interesting debate that I've had in the past with some of my associates. And when I asked this question, I got a few emails from them, and we once again renewed our discussion. And my argument was that with the anti-Olympics movement here in Vancouver, when it first started out, it was very trendy. It was very it. And it felt like it was going to make traction. The coverage focused a lot on sort of lower middle class folk, mom and pop type people who ran, you know, mom and pop's pizza parlor, small town, nice local pizza place that was getting shut down because of construction for the new SkyTrain stations or a new highway or an Olympic venue. And you had all of these people whose livelihood was going to be massively disrupted. They were going to lose their investments. They were going to lose their stores. These were things that they depended on to make do, to get by. And they were being sort of shut down. And what we saw in its place was big corporations. We saw Coca-Cola. We saw the Olympics. We saw various corporate logos and sponsors who were going to get great advertising space, who were going to get prime locations next to SkyTrain stations, but what about, you know, the folks who had a business there for the last 10 years? That was very compelling, and I think that media really went with that story. But then the conversation seemed to shift, and the people that the media were focusing on, and the people that were being presented as the face of the anti-Olympics movement went from being mom and pop, the sort of lower class, middle class people, to younger people, 20-something people with, you know, stereotypically sort of nose rings, and they were part of the anti-poverty movement. They wore balaclavas. They maybe not, but took part in civil disobedience. And all of a sudden, the narrative started to shift. It went from being, how are the Olympics harming our society, to what are those crazy young protesters up to this time? And when those young protesters, and I'm generalizing, and I'm aware of the fact that this is sort of a stereotype and this is not necessarily what actually happened, but when that narrative shifted to young protesters who were throwing bricks through windows of department stores and breaking into civic authority offices and smashing the place up, public opinion turned. And a huge favor was done to those Olympic planners, because all of a sudden they were the victims now. Now they were the innocent people who were just trying to put on some games, and some mean, nasty protesters started throwing tomatoes at them and smashing their offices and scaring them. And all of a sudden, we saw a huge shift in how the public perceived the Olympics. Public perception is a huge factor in any kind of awareness campaign. And protesting, sometimes, can turn the public against you. So why does that happen? What motivates that? Is it always violence? I mean, there have been violent protests that haven't turned the public against people. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for this question. But I would like to invite more commentary on this. If you have some thoughts or opinions, maybe you think I'm completely wrong, but definitely let me know. We'll dive into this some more in later shows. And if you tune into our show notes on sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, I'll have a few links that are worth reading. Well, let's take another just quick break here on the show. When we come back, we have a bit of information on donating, what motivates it, and what factors limit it. And then we'll dive into our Doreen's unopened letter that I'm holding in and see what they have to say. Stay tuned.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind, can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along, and I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again. Oh.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, discussing nonprofit social justice and activism. And right now on the show, the topic of donating, which frequently comes up. What motivates people to donate to various causes? And there's so many different reasons why people donate. One of them, we assume, is empathy. The ability to look at somebody's situation and feel an emotional connection to them and say, you know, that poor person, they're in trouble. I can help. I should help. And I will help. And they write a check. Now, we often assume that when we're making a donation and we're empathizing with somebody, that we put ourselves in their shoes. that we think of them in terms of someone who's down on their luck, who has maybe been dealt a bad hand, and they just need someone to give them a hand, to reach out and say, let me pull you back to your feet. This feeling, this sense that we are helping someone who's a bit hard done by, is really important to the donation process. And in a recent article on Forbes discussing this very factor, an interesting study came up. And it's called I'm Moral, But I Won't Help You: The Distinct Roles of Empathy and Justice in Donations. I'll have a link to it in our show notes so you can check it out. Very interesting stuff. I do encourage you to check it out. Basically, a group of researchers tried to figure out what is likely to draw out more donations from different people. If people are given the option of donating to a medical charity where the recipients of the donations are people who, through no fault of their own, are dealing with an illness or a disability or something that disadvantages them in some way, compared to a situation where the recipient of the donation is somebody who needs help because of what we would characterize as a lack of responsibility. In this case, maybe somebody who is dealing with drug addiction or substance abuse due to their own fault, that they got involved in drugs, they got involved in substance abuse issues, and now they're in a bad state and they need people to donate to help them out. In those two cases, where you think most favor in which a person's responsibility is not relevant? Meaning, we donate to people who, through no fault of their own, have put themselves in that position. We're less likely to donate to causes where we feel like the person is in that situation because of choices that they made, that it was a lack of responsibility on their part, that something that they did put them in that position. And interestingly enough, it's this notion of worthiness that seems to have a big impact on people who donate. And, you know, this study wasn't just done on people, random people who, you know, because you might get a group of non-charitable people and a group of charitable people. No, they took people who normally do give, and they compared it to people who are, you know, less lucky to give. So they had some interesting benchmarks to compare it to. It's a fascinating way to look at charity. And it puts the question to an organization, a nonprofit, a charity, how do you convince people to donate, especially if you're getting them to donate to a cause where people have made bad choices in life and now they need help? Because you might say that these people weren't responsible. These people exercised bad judgment. In certain eyes, they may be seen as not worthy because they're screw-ups, and why should I support somebody who made a stupid decision? So charities have to deal with this. They have to figure out a way to convince people to donate to these causes so that those people who have made bad choices can be supported. And this is where the subject of storytelling comes in. This is where nonprofits and charities have to find different ways of expressing the value of their mission. And we've talked about storytelling before on The Sector with one of our guests, Vanessa Shea. So if you want to, go check out that episode and have a listen and consider it in this new light, that people are actually going to punish charities by not donating to them if they feel like the recipients are people who exercised bad judgment in life. And that can be a major factor for someone who is thinking about donating, and it can be a major factor for the charity and the fundraiser who is trying to get those donations to make a difference. And speaking of getting donations, I have here in my hands a letter from the University of British Columbia addressed to me, Ethan Clow, asking me to make a contribution to their 2014 annual alumni appeal. I am going to open this letter. We are going to investigate it. We're going to read it together, and we're going to see how successful their direct mail is in getting me to donate. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
We're back on The Sector discussing direct mail, and you may be asking yourself, or asking me, Ethan, what is direct mail? Well, direct mail is a form of fundraising appeal where the nonprofit or charity sends you a letter. Now, it can be as fancy or as bare bones as, well, any kind of mail that you get. A lot of people, these things tend to get sort of sucked into the spam filter. You know, you flip through your mail, you go, oh, see, bill. Do I want to be a member of the what society? Spam. And you throw it out. That's why direct mail is really important for a nonprofit, because it has to be able to get past that initial spam filter that we all have inside our heads. And you would think that makes it, you know, not a very good proposition, because it's expensive to mail these things, you know, postage, the printing, the envelopes. But in actuality, direct mail is still the number one moneymaker for nonprofits in North America. Yeah, I know. So why? Well, direct mail tends to work with the number one donors in North America, the baby boomers. They like this. I mean, and you have to admit, there is something kind of nice about getting a letter with your name on it. You know, it's addressed to you. It's got your name on it. Sometimes the envelope itself, cover where it says change. And the letters are sort of cut out of the paper so you can see through it. And if you look closely, you can't see this, of course, but I'll describe it for you. I'm very good at this. You see that there are old pictures of UBC in the background. And as you go through the word change, the colors, the pictures become colorized. They become more modern. You see new institutions, new people. It's pretty slick. It's got my name on it right there, Mr. Clow. Postage paid on the back, 2014 alumni appeal. Very nice, very pretty. In this case, you know, like I said, a standard white envelope. But, you know, if you're adventurous, you can be a bit more daring with your direct mail. But let's open this up and see what we have here. So I'm just going to rip it open. You can hear me opening it live on the air. This is really happening. And we'll pull it out. So every direct mail is going to have several parts, and this is what makes it effective. So pulling it apart here, I have the return envelope. This is incredibly important. So important. If you're in charge of a direct mail and you do not include the return envelope, expect to be fired. Because it is the most important part of the direct mail. This envelope, oh, and this is fancy. The inside is all decorated with University of British Columbia branding on it. It's got the university's address, the development office. It's got a postage paid. That's very important. You definitely need to have that. It's lick. You know, you have to lick it. It's not one of those stickers, which is a minus. Let's face it. No one likes that. So aside from the envelope, we have the appeal itself. This is quite nice. So you have the change. And if you go online to sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, I will post a few pictures of this so you can take a look at it yourself. You open up the envelope or the folded paper, and it's got two photos of UBC then and now. You unfold the page, and it's got a nice, about four-paragraph letter. On the other side is signed by an official here. And then there at the bottom of the page is a tearaway donation slip. This is another major part of any direct mail appeal. This is where the donor, in this case me, after I read the hopefully really fascinating, really interesting appeal, I go down to the bottom here. There is a perforated tearaway. Above the tear, there is a little red box with writing in it, which says startanevolution.ca, which I assume is their campaign website. And this is interesting. So in nice coloring, very good layout, very fancy. Yes, I would like to support the 2014 Annual Alumni Appeal. It's got my name and address on it, which I won't share. Got my email address, a phone number, which is a nice touch. Let's see. And then it says, this is really important. These are its asks. And this is where the direct mail will be successful or where it will fail. Now the way that we read letters, we read left to right. So furthest left is the largest gift amount, $100, then $50, then $35, and then an other that lets me write it in. Little boxes that I check. Below the single gift category is monthly gift. Same thing, the larger amount is to the left. Monthly gift, $20, $15, $10, other. Again, specified as a monthly gift. And then this is interesting. Below that, they give me the option to direct my funds. Please direct my gift to the History Department, Traveling Scholars Fund, other. Lets me fill it in. This is interesting. Now, of course, my department was history. So they have obviously done enough research on me to know that if I'm like most alumni, I'm going to donate back to the department that I was part of. So having the history department there, that's a really good step. What they do here in terms of donation amounts is known as anchoring. They give me $100, $50, $35. Now, they obviously want the $100. That's what their main ask is. Now, if I was doing this, I would have put the monthly gift above single gift, so maybe a half a point off, whatever. But they know that not everybody's going to send $100. They actually know that really well. They will be happy to get $35. $50, however, that's where they hope that most people will land. And it's really important that they anchor us, first of all. So $100, $50, $35. They're not going down in $50 breaks here, right? It's not $155, $35. So the social pressure on me, of course, is, well, I may not give $100, but $35, that's the lowest amount on here. I don't want to be cheap. $50. Right? That's the psychological game that not just UBC, but all charities will play. They're trying to motivate you to give, and they will use this anchoring method to sort of psychologically, give you an edge, to give you sort of right in the middle. And that can be a pretty useful technique if you're hoping to get a certain amount, $50, $100. You ask a little bit higher than what it is, and then you put sort of the cheap ask, which is, if you won't give the big amount and you won't give the medium amount, will you give at least, X amount? And a lot of people, when they see the low amount, will go, well, I'm not that cheap. I'll give the middle amount. And that's what they're hoping for. So let's take a look at this in a bit more detail. Now, I mentioned that this is longer than your standard letter. This is about twice as long in terms of pure paper length. It's folded into sort of four quarters, so it kind of folds up accordion style, which is kind of nice. It's got the pictures at the top, right below or underneath the cutout change. And then there's the paragraphs of explanation, and I'll read that in a moment. So, good quality paper stock, nice, looks good, simple design, pretty good direct mail. let's see what it actually says in their quest to get me to donate. Dear Mr. Clow, these days, every time I take a walk around UBC, I see something new. It feels like the campus is constantly growing, with new buildings and new ideas on every corner. It is likely that, as an alumnus, you're aware of it too. It's a byproduct of the same energy that is continually generating new thoughts and innovations. All across campus, you can feel the commitment to changing the world. At the Department of History, the student experience is central to everything we do. Research done right here at UBC has shown that students in interactive classroom sessions are twice as engaged as in traditional lectures. As a result of these findings, the university has transformed the student learning experience. Changes in technology and in society are what drive the changes you see on campus. Students themselves are often profoundly changed during their time at university. UBC expands horizons. To achieve their dreams, students will always need the support of our committed alumni. That is something that has not changed. This year, our priority for the 2014 Annual Alumni Appeal is the History Department Annual Fund. This fund provides vital support to the department, opportunities, and some gaps appear. Funds help support crucial activities such as colloquia and workshops, faculty research and teaching, and special presentations to our undergraduate students, including support for the History Students Association. Please make a donation to support the History Department Annual Fund. Your one-time gift of $50 or ongoing monthly contribution of $15 will benefit students directly by enhancing many of our undergraduate and graduate learning experience. Make your gift today by mail by calling blah 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 or start online blah blah blah. Please turn over. Change is constant, and this year also brings another kind of change to UBC. We say goodbye to President blah blah blah, who in his 8 years as president has done so much to elevate the university. President blah blah is committed to innovation and the student experience, so I'm sure we'll see more of the positive changes that are now central to UBC. Our alumni help shape the vision of UBC. That vision drives the progress which we see manifested in changes across campus. The constant here is students, ambitious, talented students with ideas that could help make the world a better place. And they just need your help to do it. Thank you for your support. Signed, blah, 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 blah. P.S. UBC's campus is in constant evolution, driven by the aspirations of everybody connected to it. Make your gift by blah, 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 and it will support students to change their world and ours from this September. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So, thoughts, listeners, what do you think of that appeal? Now, there's one thing that jumps out at me the first time I read through this, and that is, do you think they want me to think about the word change a lot? I mean, granted, at the top of the page and cut out letters, change, okay. But then in some of these paragraphs, the word change or changes appears about four times. That's a lot of times to have the word change. You know, you got to vary your vocab. Otherwise, people are going to tune out. I don't know. What did you think about that? Was that too wordy? A bit long, don't you think? That was 5 paragraphs in the span of about, 7 inches. And then it says, turn. I don't know. I mean, don't you want to complete your ask in one go? Do you really want to risk the chance that I'm going to be a little bit too busy and just be like, oh, I'll read the rest later and throw it on a pile and it never gets answered? But you turn it over and you got this sort of last closing paragraph, which talks about the outgoing president and the new sort of president who's coming in. A final sort of butter up here, the vision that drives the progress we see manifested in changes, ambitious students, and they need my help. You know, that's really the kind of thing that needs to go on the front side of this, in my opinion. But overall, not a bad ask. This isn't terrible. This is not the worst piece of direct mail that I've ever received. It's not the best, but it's not the worst. Did you notice the part On the last paragraph on the first page that I read, please make a donation to support the History Department Annual Fund. Your one-time gift of $50. Now, remember when I talked about how they anchor the gift expectations at the bottom of the page here in the on the tearaway? On the far left, there's $100, then $50, then $35, then other. Now, they didn't ask me to make a gift of $100. They asked my one-time gift of $50. Or ongoing monthly contribution of $15. Now, again, the highest amount listed, $10, is the lower amount. And there's the, you know, other for the cheapskates. Why don't you think they asked me for $100 or $20 in the paragraph section of the letter? That's a bit strange. Perhaps a missed opportunity. I don't know. What do you all think? Now, another factor is, of course, we know that monthly giving is the bread and butter of the nonprofit world. That's the most profitable area to get your donors. You want them to go from the single gifters to the monthly giving. And you might say, well, the single gifts are really attractive because they're one-time payments. People can write the check, they're done with it. But in actuality, psychologically speaking, a monthly gift is often an easier sell. It's an easier sell because usually the monthly gift amount is quite low. It doesn't have the same impact of asking for $100. If you ask for $10 a month, well, it just doesn't have that same oomph to it, you know? Now, usually you want to make sure that the monthly gift adds up at the end of the year to the single gift, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. That way, you can spin it in the sense that the monthly gift is a bit more economically feasible because it's in small doses. You just sort of let the gift go, and it will eventually expire. What's interesting, of course, is that on the monthly system, which is where they want all their donors anyway, because that's more profitable, they didn't put that front and center. They didn't make that, you know, the main focus of the ask, trying to get me to donate on a monthly schedule. The most focus is on the one-time gift, which, I don't know, that could be a missed opportunity right there. What else? What else did we notice about this that, I don't know, piques our interest? If we look at the tearaway, the most important part, the place where you make your gift, whether I select the single gift or the monthly gift, where I direct my gift to either the history department or perhaps a different section of the foundation, I turn it over, and on the back is the payment methods, equally important as the rest of the ask. So what options do they give me? Well, I can do a check where I check the box and I indicate whether or not I have enclosed a void check, which obviously is for direct deposit, or if I'm making a single gift and have enclosed a payable check to the University of British Columbia. Or we can go by credit card. And again, direct mail, as I said, very popular, very effective, one of the most proven methods of fundraising that there is. And I mean, we may doubt that based on sort of the way that I've kind of criticized this, but it actually is the best bet for nonprofits. Now, so back to credit cards. This is really important. Baby boomers like the credit card. Giving by credit card is probably the most common way that we donate these days. Yeah, we do cash. You know, that happens. That's usually at events with one of those donation boxes. We put in a $20 bill. We're not going to put cash in an envelope and mail to UBC. Checks still happen. I mean, there is something satisfying about pulling out your checkbook and writing an amount on it and donating it to somebody. So they always are going to have the check. The credit card, always important. You have a spot to write your credit card number. I'm not going to give that out. Your cardholder name, the signature, expiry date, And very important, information on your tax receipt. To receive your tax receipt, please return this form in the enclosed envelope or return to, and they give you the address. They give you a phone number, a fax number, an email amount, email number, email address, number. I'm crazy. They give you all that information because if you're giving money to somebody, you want that contact information. That's very important, very smart, very good planning on their part. Next to the payment method is a small section. Thank you for your gift. Big, bold letters. Thanking people. That's very important. Not crazy about the way they've laid this out. The payment method on the left, the thank you on the right, kind of a square box. I would have maybe rearranged that so it's all sort of one long section with the thank you more included and more prominent in the actual payment system. There's also a link. You can also donate online at, and then there's like an address. There is some small print. Small print is risky. It makes it look like you're up to something. So, you know, that's iffy. Now, it's not, you know, it's not like small print as in like a car commercial, but it is small-ish. And it kind of goes over the tax receipting within 4 weeks. Monthly donors will receive it at the year end. When the contributions will appear on your credit card. Information on this form collected by the university, blah, blah, blah. Privacy, charitable business number. So, important information. The presentation, not the best. I don't think that I'm giving them a hard time on that one. That's a bit iffy. One thing that I will say, and good on them, they did not include one of those stupid QR codes. You know, those big, ugly things of, those sort of like a fancy barcode that you scan with your phone. You see them around still today on business cards and like posters. I have never seen someone actually scan one of those things. I think I scanned one once about 5 years ago, and it took me about 15 minutes to get the phone to recognize the stupid thing. Don't use those, folks. Don't put those stupid codes on your donor forms. They confuse people. They're ugly. They're eyesores. You know, just don't do it. Don't do it. So overall, a pretty good direct mail appeal. Has some issues. A few things that we sort of nibbled on that we kind of criticized. But fundraising machines in Canada, they have some of the most talented and intelligent fundraisers this side of the continent. These people are smart. So believe you me, all the things that we noticed that I talked about on today's show, they're well aware of. They are fixing it as we speak. So don't be too worried about them. They are well on the ball. And this campaign will be successful. UBC is sophisticated enough, they're well run enough to know not to run a campaign that's going to lose money. I would wager that they've already made back the initial investment of sending out the direct mail. The long-term benefits, of course, will far outweigh small costs if enough people sign up as monthly giving. Even if they don't sign up as monthly givers, and they give one time, UBC will come back to them. Because who is most likely to give? The people who have already given. That is one of the oldest tricks in the fundraiser handbook. So UBC will keep diligent records. They will probably, if they're smart, and I bet they've done this, they may have even sent out a few different versions of this to sort of test it out, see how it works. So maybe some alumni like me got this version, and perhaps a few alumni got a slightly different version. Maybe different wording, different colors, different design. They want to know exactly what appeal will have the best result. And that's why they're going to test it. And, maybe the other appeal won't have the envelope that I have to lick. Maybe it'll have that nice pull-away, tapey paper thing, which, let's face it, we all prefer. UBC, don't make us lick envelopes. We're giving you money. Don't make us lick envelopes. Well, that is the dissection of a direct mail ask. I hope you enjoyed it. Now, before we wrap up for today's show, I would like to once again present the new big question of the week. And as a reminder, If you want to participate in the big question of the week, you can. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can contribute on Twitter at sectorpodcast or tweet me at Ethan Clow. And take the conversation to Facebook. Facebook.com/sectorpodcast is our page. You may feel free to like it at your convenience. And visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. We will also post our show notes and our podcast links so you can download back issues of The Sector. You can also check out my pictures to go along with my dissection of the UBC ask, so check those out. And I'd love your feedback on that. What do you think? Maybe you worked on the campaign and you want to tell me where I can go. Well, you can do that. So I encourage you to participate in the big question. And of course, what is the big question of the week? Engagement. And no, not marriage proposals. Engagement as in getting engaged with a charity. How do you do that? And I'm asking you as the public out there, how do you engage with a charity? Let's say that there's a cause that you feel passionate about, that you really, really care about. How do you reach out and connect with them? Is it by Facebook? Is it by Twitter? Do you follow them maybe on Instagram? Or is it an ongoing communication where you are in contact with volunteers and staff? Do you make phone calls, inquiries, emails? Do you get involved directly? Do you call them up and say, hey, I like the cut of your jib and I want to be involved. I want to volunteer. So how do you do that? How do you decide what provokes that response in you? Sometimes it's all about the cause itself. It's about feeling a direct, personal, emotional connection to a mission that you are already engaged. Find these people who are doing great work and you want to join them. In other cases, somebody has shared something, maybe on charities. They're asking themselves the same question. They want to know how to engage you. They want to know how do they translate Facebook likes into action. How do you translate a retweet into activism? Or is a like and a retweet and a share, is that activism? I know we're sort of getting back to that discussion of slacktivism, but let's indulge ourselves a little bit. Is that activism in your opinion? Is it actually directly getting involved if you like a Facebook post or you share a Facebook post or you retweet or you follow or you Twitter, whatever it is you do online and social media? Do you consider that engagement activism? Or is that something a little bit different? Maybe that's sort of like the pre-steps to activism. So what motivates you to make the plunge? What ultimately draws you out of being a silent observer to an active participant? We want to know here on The Sector. We're very curious about that sort of thing. So as I said, email us, tweet us, Facebook us, let us know. And we will discuss the answers next week on the show when we dive into this topic a bit more thoroughly. We'll have some new interesting content about engagement and exactly what role is social media playing in engagement. Is it making it better or, as some have discussed, perhaps it's actually making it worse? Is slacktivism causing a detriment to the nonprofit world? We will discuss those and more next week on the show. Well, this is Ethan Clow, your host on The Sector, saying thank you once again for tuning in. Enjoy the World Cup. Enjoy the sunshine. Enjoy the warm weather. Get out there and enjoy it while it lasts, because let's face it, it's not going to last. Once again, thank you for tuning in. See you all next week. Enjoy the weekend, folks. Bye-bye.